The Robber Barons, Labor and Wages, Part 2, The Great Strikes. From the earliest times, the captains of industry really disliked worker unions, or worker combinations, as they were called. The most notable labor disputes before 1860 arose in the great textile mills of New England, and the resolution of the masters in opposing the unlawful demands of labor is illustrated by the words of a cotton maker of Fall River, Colonel Borden, whose men, women, and children went on strike in 1850 against a 13-hour workday. Colonel Borden said, quote, "I saw that mill built stone by stone. I saw the pickers, the carting engines, the spinning mules, and the looms put into it, one after the other. And I would see every machine and stone crumble to the floor and fall again before I will accede to your wishes." Nice guy. A generation later, Jim Fisk, in a strike of the Erie Railroad brakeman, sent a gang of street toughs from New York with orders to shoot down any man who resisted. This actually aroused widespread admiration for his sterling courage. Fisk's reaction to labor unrest was largely typical of the American sentiment. Henry Ward Beecher sounded the feelings of the majority of U.S. citizens who were not urban laborers when in 1875 he said, quote, "Labor unions are the worst form of despotism and tyranny in the history of Christendom," end of quote. The barons of industry continued to set all softer considerations for those in the economic and technological progress in their business. But mine owners found a way of altering the weight of a ton of coal, which a miner must dig, from 2,340 pounds to 2,700 pounds to even 4,000 pounds. In his telegraph monopoly, Jay Gould removed older experienced workers and replaced them with young inexperienced workers, of course, at much lower salaries, which business leaders considered just in politics. Stockyard houses trained their workers in the art of simplified mass production, while the railroad baron Jim Hill boasted, quote, "I will make one engine do the work of three and dispose of two crews," end of quote. In the railroads, workers felt particularly indispensable due to the need for experience and the close coordination of all movements. They also tended to effectively unite in their own interests. In 1877, the actions of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad and the Pennsylvania Railroad twice reduced the workers' wages by 10% and then began running double headers, that is 34 freight cars instead of 17 behind a single engine and with a single crew. And of course, this leads all sorts of safety issues. One engine can barely stop 17 cars, let alone 34, and the crews knew that. This provoked a very determined strike, which quickly spread to other railroad lines and assumed a national character. The railroad armies, in their desperation, developed a violence surpassing the English Captain Swing machine wreckers. That's a reference to when McCormick reapers were sent into England to do the harvesting. Now, one of the highest paid farm workers was a reaper. It was quite a technical skill to be able to do it exactly right. And these people made their entire year's living in those few months of harvesting. When the McCormick reapers came in, you didn't need to be an expert. You just needed somebody to run the machine. And those people quickly realized they were doomed. So they began damaging the machines. They actually would put them together in farms, protect them. They brought troops in. Anybody who damaged a machine was then exiled to Australia or Tasmania. It's called the Captain Swing Movement because people would throw rocks with threats on them, signed Captain Swing. So it got pretty much out of hand. In Pittsburgh, $5 million in property was destroyed by the riots and looting, and the railroad barons were only saved by calling out the militia, that's the National Guard, and finally, federal troops who put down the strike with a lot of blood spilled. Now industrial barons not only made a habit of calling soldiers to their aid, but began erecting military armories in major cities for their convenience. Though the railroad strike was broken, remarkable enthusiasm was now engendered among the workers. workers, and there resulted a great expansion in the recently organized Knights of Labor, the secret and fraternal organization which carried on throughout the country a crusade of sorts against capitalism. By 1885, the Noble Order of Knights of Labor held a certain terror for the rulers of the great industries. A victorious strike against Jay Gould's Missouri Pacific Railroad in 1885 brought numerous recruits to the order, which aroused great hope amongst the workers for having conquered the man who was believed to be the strongest and the wiliest of capitalists. The might of the Knights of Labor was exaggerated in the press, claiming there were 500,000 members. However, Gould, with his usual shiftiness, and that's being kind, didn't abide by the terms of the settlement. He quickly discriminated against union members and directed shop work to be sent to other plants where the work was done at a lower cost. The result was a second and more violent strike in 1886. Here, 9,000 men under the firebrand leadership of Martin Irons spread an uprising that went to adjoining railroad systems. Railroad property was besieged, was captured, and business was paralyzed in the southwestern part of the United States. And then we get dueling letters. Terence V. Powderly, Grand Master of the Knights of Labor, wrote his challenge to Gould. Quote, "The system, which reaches out on all sides, gathering in millions of dollars of treasure and keeping them out of the legitimate channels of trade and commerce, must die. I play no game of bluff or chance. I speak for 500,000 organized men." Gould then replies, "In answer to these personal threats, I beg to say that I am yet a free American citizen. I am 49 years of age. I began life in a lowly way, and by industry, temperance, and attention to my own business, have been successful, perhaps beyond the measure of my deserts. If, as you say, I am now to be destroyed by the Knights of Labor, unless I sink my manhood, so be it." Wow, that's good stuff. And, of course, in the end, he wins that strike. Gould's letter was widely publicized and brought many flattering responses, which is, up to this point, he hadn't ever heard anything like that. After all, remember, this is the Mephistopheles of Wall Street, a man who people said when you deal with him, it's like dealing with death. So to say kind things to him was kind of odd. At any rate, as I said, Gould won the strike after a long struggle and deprivations to the people of the whole southwestern United States. He won it as he had won the Western Union strike in 1883. After 1886, an even greater force and authority was marshaled on the behalf of the alarmed industrial barons. The lockout, especially used by Carnegie, and the blacklist, the list of people who were union that you just didn't hire. And then ironclad oaths, where you can get the job, but you promise not to join a union, were now enforced by the monopolists acting together. They conspired together. Finally, then, after the Haymarket riot in Chicago, where the explosion of a deadly bomb stirred public opinion to the boiling point, all the forces of law and order, local judge, militia, the President of the United States, and the Supreme Court, all united to crush the conspiracy of labor. And then things will get really bad for labor, and the industrialists will then continue making money, but they're running out of time. People are going to want change here pretty soon. Now, the sources for this, of course, that's the same ones that I have been using. That is Josephson's The Robber Barons, America in the Gilded Age by Cashman, and The Age of Moguls, The Story of Robber Barons and Tycoons by Holbrook. Interesting to note that a lot of what I talked about tonight, the blacklists, the shipping out your stuff to other non-union shops, lockouts, all standard operating procedures in dealing with strikes, even nowadays. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to donate and support us. Thank you very much.